Good evening and welcome to Indie Radio News, the weekly radio news program from The Independent, a free progressive monthly newspaper and online news site based here in New York. We cover social justice movements and the issues they are fighting for, both here in the city and around the world. We are your hosts, Elia Gran and Lydia McMullen-Laird. We are only about a week away from the midterms, and on today's program, we will look at voter suppression and we'll look at takeaways from the history of the Republican Party. But first, the synagogue massacre in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. A gunman opened fire Saturday at the Tree of Life Synagogue while congregants were celebrating the Sabbath. 11 people were killed, another 4 were wounded. The youngest was 54, the oldest 97. The first funeral for David Rosenthal and his older brother Cecil is planned for Tuesday. It was the type of violence that seemed impossible to many who called the neighborhood home. The gunman, Robert Bowers, a white supremacist, is in custody. He appeared in court today. Bowers is charged with 29 federal charges. Prosecutors are pressing for the death penalty. The shooter used an AR-15-style assault rifle and 3 handguns. 29 guns were registered in his name. Social media rants show that he posted hateful messages against Jews, immigrants, and Muslims. Immigrants' rights groups say he targeted the synagogue because people were in solidarity with migrants and refugees. Meanwhile, law enforcement agencies around the U.S. have deployed extra officers at synagogues and Jewish centers. And at a news conference, Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams, a former NYPD captain, urged off-duty officers to bring guns when they attended religious services.
Carrying a fire, if we have police officers standing, in front of churches, then we can't say it's wrong for a police officer who's off duty to be inside churches with a gun. The first thing we do when we have a shooting of this nature, we deploy police officers to be outside. We have police officers in just about every synagogue I passed by today, there was a police officer's car out front. So if we're saying it's all right for a police officer to park out front to protect the people inside, then it does not seem unreasonable for off-duty police officers who go to their synagogue to worship to also protect the people inside. These are the same police officers. Just one happens to be on duty, one happens to be off duty. That's a perfect match to protect people that are harmed. I read the numbers. Not only are the synagogue, but our churches are being attacked. Our Muslim Sikh temples are being attacked. We have to live in this real universe that we're in. And if we have officers who are trained on how to respond to emergencies, how to move people to safety, how to properly use a police or a firearm, if they're leaving those firearms home, I am now saying to them, stop leaving your firearm homes. Do as I do. Bring your firearm to church.
The mayor of Pittsburgh, Bill Peduto, says the city is in mourning but will recover. He says more guns isn't the answer.
I don't think that the answer to this problem is solved by having our synagogues, mosques, and churches filled with armed guards or our schools filled with armed guards. I think we're dealing with an irrational person who acted irrationally, and trying to create laws around that is not the way that we should govern. We should try to stop irrational behavior from happening at the forefront and not try to create laws around irrational behavior to continue.
The outpouring of love and support for Pittsburgh is incredibly appreciated during this time. And there is a commonality throughout the world of people who have had enough of this type of hate based upon somebody's practice of religion or somebody's national origin. There is an outpouring that is being heard through the people of Pittsburgh right now of where people want to see society move towards. And it is not about finding ways to divide us. It is about finding ways that unite us through our commonality as humans. Let this horrific episode be another mark in the march of humanity towards recognizing that we are all one.
U.S. House of Representatives candidate from Queens, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, tweeted, "Imagine if it was ISIS that sent bombs to U.S. officials, started shooting in grocery stores, and invading places of worship. How do you think this administration would respond? And why is the response so different when those same terrorist acts are committed by white supremacists?" In New York, religious leaders and elected officials came together in solidarity following the massacre. Sophie Elman-Gollin was at the vigil. She's with Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. Hello, Sophie. Can you tell us about the vigil? Sophie?
Yeah. Hi.
Thank you for joining us. Sophie, can you tell us a little bit about how Saturday's vigil went?
Yeah. Saturday's vigil was really, really powerful. You know, we put out the call that afternoon or late morning, right after, only a couple hours after we heard the word. And we estimate over 300 people came. And what was really powerful was we had our Muslim partners and neighbors and friends and community members hold the space for us. They did security to make us feel safe, stood with us, and that was really powerful as well. And that's in many ways part of the deep partnership we have. You know, when Muslim communities have done iftar in the streets, we as Jews and JFRG in particular, we've stood and held space for them to make them feel safe, and so they just showed up immediately and did it for us, and it was really beautiful.
How many people would you say turned out to the event, and in what percentage do you think there were diversity of nationality and cultures and religions?
I would say over 300 people came, which is a lot for something that has very little time. I think it was majority Jews who were looking for a space to be, but there were also many, many people who were not Jewish, who were there to stand with us.
And now when you think about moving on, especially like what are your first instincts in how to deal with the situation and sort of move through the trauma of the massacre?
It feels incredibly important in this moment to make sure people understand why this happened. And part of that is the rise of anti-Semitism in this country. And the ways that is deeply tied to and a key part of white nationalism. So we know that the shooter held these beliefs. We also know that the president of the United States has shared these beliefs widely. We also know that, frankly, the same conspiracy theories about George Soros and Jews, you know, fostering dissent and being behind protests or the, you know, the arrival of immigrants. We've heard that same rhetoric from people like Chuck Grassley and Kevin McCarthy. And so it's important that we identify what has actually created an environment in which armed white nationalists can go out and attack Jews. And not just Jews, but also black folks, also Muslims. You know, it's all of us.
Thank you, Sophie. And for all our listeners who want to join in upcoming vigils or rallies, is there anything planned out that we can share?
We don't have anything specific quite yet, but stay tuned. And if you follow JFRGNYC on Twitter, or you follow Jews for Racial and Economic Justice on Facebook, or go to jfreg.org, that's JFREJ.org, we will be sure to keep you updated.
Thank you so much, Sophie Elman-Gollin.
Today, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell denounced the Pittsburgh synagogue massacre and Kentucky grocery store shooting as hate crimes. He said the death penalty should be applied. The Kentucky Republican also said the shooting last week underscored the need to ratchet down political rhetoric. McConnell, known for his own bare-knuckled political style, said the country needs to get into a better, more respectful place. But today, Donald Trump returned to his often repeated narrative of accusing the media of being the true enemy of the people. This in the wake of the mass shooting and mail bomb plot targeting Democrats and CNN. Although there have been calls for Trump to tone down his rhetoric, he continues to be divisive. Today he tweeted, "There is great anger in our country caused in part by inaccurate and even fraudulent reporting of the news." He added that the media must stop the open and obvious hostility and report the news accurately and fairly. Meanwhile, Cesar Sayoc, the Florida man who stands accused of mailing the pipe bombs that spurred a week-long coast-to-coast investigation, faces 5 federal charges. He appeared in a Florida court this afternoon and will be tried in New York.
Welcome back to Indie Radio News, live on WBAI 99.5. We are your hosts, Lydia McMullen-Lehrer and Elia Grand. Today, as our first guest, we have Greg Pallas, an investigative journalist and director of the groundbreaking film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, to talk to us about voter suppression. In his 2016 documentary, Pallas exposed the purge of around 1 million voters in the November elections, and his most recent investigation, he reports on the cancellation of around 340,000 votes registration by Georgia's Secretary of State, Brian Kemp. Greg, thank you for coming on our show.
I'm glad to be back at the BAI, my old home station. Now I'm in L.A. I just came back from Georgia. I'm going back Friday because I filed a federal lawsuit in Atlanta federal court against Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State.
Can you tell us a little bit, diving into this recent investigation, can you tell us a little bit about how you picked up on this case and sort of the role of local organizations played in helping you gather all this information?
Oh, yeah. For those who know me, I'm an investigative reporter, and I've been following the kind of purging, cancellation of registration of voters of color since the 2000 election. And it's not like I want to start from prehistory, but you really need to know that this just didn't start this year with Brian Kemp or Georgia or anything else. Catherine Harris removed tens of thousands of black people from the voter rolls in 2000. I reported that for The Guardian and newspapers and BBC television. That's how George Bush won. That game has not stopped. It's just got more sophisticated. Brian Kemp is probably the poster boy for 26 secretaries of state, almost all of them Republican, but not all, who've been purging voters from the voter rolls using a phony system which falsely identifies people as having moved out of the state or out of their congressional district.
What do you call this method?
And we call it purge by postcard.
Right.
And so what's happened in Georgia is that Brian Kemp removed over 500,000 people from the voter rolls. And you had very little discussion of this in the local press. And don't confuse this with the much, much smaller amount of voters, 53,000, who were not registered, not added to the voter rolls. They've been waiting, and some of them, by the way, I've been on Brian Kemp's case in Georgia for Democracy Now, Rolling Stone, and Al Jazeera for 5 years, and some of those registrations are literally 5 years old. They've been waiting to get on the voter rolls.
Wow.
And so what Kemp has said in his defense is, if they show up with the right ID on November 6th, those 53,000 can vote. I'm not sure how that's going to actually work out when you show up at the polls and say, But this is even bigger.
Right.
And was not covered by, the mainstream press. What I did was I demanded that Kemp turn over the names of these 500,000 people who were purged from the voter rolls, supposedly for moving.
Right.
And I'm the only reporter that actually got the list. And, yes, I am working with local organizations, the New Georgia Project. And, in fact, my co-plaintiff in the lawsuit is Joseph Lowry's organization, the great civil rights leader, his organization, the Georgia Coalition for People's Agenda. NAACP Atlanta, The Reverend Jesse Jackson himself is my co-plaintiff in Illinois and flew down to Atlanta to work with me on this. And a lot of very good organizations on the ground, just right. No help from the press. So thank you for putting this on. So we got the half million names. And two things that you notice right away is a lot of names of voters of color. You know, Rodriguez, Garcia, Kim Brown, Jackson. How'd that work? And then the real punchline is that how did Kemp decide these people move from Georgia or, you know, move somewhere else? And the answer is, well, first, that they missed an election or two. So they become what they call inactive voters. Now, in the United States of America, you have the right to vote. You have the right not to vote. It's in the National Voter Registration Act of 93 says specifically, you cannot lose your registration for not voting. So why is he even keeping a list of non-voters?
Right.
People who've missed an election. The answer is that you miss an election, they send you a postcard. And if you don't answer the postcard, they say, well, we can't throw you off the rolls for not sending back a postcard. We can't throw you off the rolls for missing a vote. But if you put those two together, we use that as evidence you've moved. We can remove you because you've moved away.
And I wanted to ask you in a bigger, because you've been studying various types of voter suppression, not only
yes.
Also cross-checking.
Yes.
Cases in Kansas, Florida. Can you tell us a little bit about what other types of voter suppression tactics we should be aware of?
That's why I call my book "The Best Democracy Money Can Buy."
Right.
Has a subtitle: 10 Ways to How to Steal an Election in 10 Easy Steps." Because there's 10 basic ways. But for example, Brian Kemp can illustrate all of them. Purging voters. He said they moved. He moves. He's been closing and moving polling stations. There was a big national story that they try to close most of the polling stations in Randolph County, which is majority black, and that got stopped. What the national media did not cover is that there's 159 counties, and in most of those counties, they have been closing polling stations, like in Georgia's 6th Congressional District, in African-American areas and Asian-American areas, which is also Democratic heavy. And a lot of polls are closed in the Georgia 6th, which runs from Atlanta, where it's African-American, up to Alpharetta, which is quite white. So you want to vote white, you got a polling station right near you. If you're in Atlanta, good luck.
And I wanted to ask you a little bit. So in New York, we still don't have early voting, and we have or automatic voter registration, and there are very strict rules about who can vote in party primaries. So can you tell us a little bit how we can overcome these insidious voter suppression tactics in general? Like, what solutions?
Fight like hell. In fact, I have to say a shout-out in New York to Neil Rosenstein of NYPIRG, who is head of their voter legal attack, basically the flying attack squad. He's head of the lawyers fighting for voting rights in New York City. And, by the way, he is one of the funders of my work in his foundation funding my work in Georgia.
And
one of the things that you have to do is, number one, you have a Democratic Party which is quite hostile to low-income voters, some parts of the Democratic Party, as you well know, Andrew Cuomo. And so, of course, he doesn't – they know who votes early. You have Souls to the Polls days coming out of churches on Sundays. They see the rest of the nation who votes on the Sunday early, and that's African-American voters. They're not Andrew Cuomo's voters. So he's going to keep. So the last thing he's going to do is have early voting. You do have lots of problems in Brooklyn in the 2016 primary between Clinton and Sanders. You know, you had people purged again, can't have their registration canceled just before the primary vote without any notice to them. That was illegal.
Well, Greg, we're running a little bit out of time.
Mm-hmm. So the answer is you got to fight. So if you go, by the way, so if you go to gregpalace.com,
right.
If you have friends, if they're in Colorado, Arizona, Illinois, Indiana, Nebraska, Georgia, tell them to go to gregpalace.com and see if they are. We've gotten these purge lists and see if they're purged. The punchline, by the way, in Georgia is that we had experts who determined that 340,134, that's a third of a million people in Georgia, were removed from the voter rolls because they moved away. And I can guarantee you I have the names and addresses of those voters. They haven't moved one inch. We can name them. We can find them. There they are, Mr. Kemp. You removed them.
Thank
that's
you.
That's how this election is being
thank you so much,
manipulated.
Greg. Thank you for coming on, and we'll continue watching the voter suppression upcoming to the midterm elections. Now we move on to the second part of the program with Lydia McMullen-Lehrer and John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of The Independent.
Welcome back to Indie Radio News on WBAI. If you're just joining us, we are joined now by John Tarleton, the editor-in-chief of The Independent. John wrote an article for this month's issue of The Indie that looks at how the Republican Party has gained power over the past half century. It's called The Long Game: What the Left Can Learn from the GOP's Rise to Power. Welcome, John.
Hi, Lydia. It's great to be here.
In our last segment, we heard from Greg Palast about voter suppression. And if you missed that segment, you can check it out on the Independent SoundCloud. So you argue that voter suppression is just one tactic in a much larger effort by the Republicans to consolidate right-wing power. In your article, you talk about some of the examples of this, including the founding of Fox News by media mogul Robert Murdoch in 1996, the Bush-Gore election in 2000, and how Republicans exploited 9/11. What stands out as some of the common themes in terms of the strategy that Republicans have used to gain power over the last few decades?
Yes, I was inspired to write this piece last month after the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation. There was a lot of anguish over among activists seeing the Supreme Court land firmly in the hands of the right wing. And with the midterm elections coming up, I wanted to try to give people a sense of how we ended up in this situation where the Republican Party, which their agenda is not that popular with the general public, yet they control most of the levers of power in the country right now. So how did this happen? And I did look back over time. In part, I wanted to do this to give those of us on the left a sense of like what it would take to reverse this and what we might be able to learn from the Republicans. Because while their agenda is very malicious and harmful, clearly they understood something that got them where they are.
And how did this get started, or what sort of prompted this strategy?
Well, the conservative movement in this country has never accepted any notion of social progress. That they resented the New Deal reforms of the 1930s greatly, and then the progress we saw for all sorts of historically oppressed groups in the movements of the 1960s was also something they never accepted. And so by the late 1960s, you had a situation where the left was gaining strength. You had all these social movements that were calling into question all sorts of traditional social arrangements and also questioning capitalism, imperialism, the whole system. And while the right-wing opposition to social progress doesn't begin at any one particular moment, I started my piece with looking at a memo that a corporate attorney named Lewis Powell wrote in 1971. He served on the board of directors of a number of corporations and wrote this memo for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce months before Richard Nixon put him on the Supreme Court. And Powell was essentially looking at how the power of big business in the free enterprise system, as he called it, could be restored in this country. And he argued for a number of different measures to essentially influence the media, academia, and change the whole conversation around business and conservative values in this country.
Can you give some examples of how that has played out after the Powell memo?
Sure. One clear way was that you started to see a number of conservative think tanks open up. The Heritage Foundation is the largest and longest running that really became these propaganda factories for introducing ideas into the media and the larger public. Also, a big business began to form groups like the Business Roundtable to much more aggressively advocate for their agenda. And while Powell was concerned mostly with restoring the power of big business, ultimately to be able to do that, they had to find the conservative movement had to build a larger mass base, and that's where you start to see the alliance with evangelical Christians and other social conservatives who were alarmed by the you know, more promiscuous culture that came out of the 1960s and wanted to turn back the clock on abortion rights and gay rights and a number of other reforms from that era. And so that those pieces began to come together, and then we start to see the agenda moving.
So in some of the examples you give in your article, for example, exploiting 9/11 or, you know, the election in 2000, these are strategies that the left might not want to adopt just because they had such negative impacts on the years after. So when you say in the title of your article what the left can learn from the GOP, what are some things that you would recommend for the left? And what do you mean by that in terms of lessons that the left can learn?
It's not to replicate their actions and how they've used their power, but to understand how they got where they were to be in a position to do those things. So how do we get to a position where we can do the things we want to do, which are obviously much more positive policies?
And what do you see as the weakness in the left right now in the strategy that the left has used as opposed to the GOP?
Well, I think first of all, they have to understand the Republicans have access to vast resources. The left is always under-resourced. Nonetheless, I think the key things that we can learn from the conservative movement is they were incredibly persistent over many decades. And they understood the importance of winning the battle of ideas in the public. They also did all the like grunt work on the ground. They first started running for school boards and state legislatures and all of that. And they had setbacks along the way. They had numerous setbacks, but they never really got discouraged. They just kept on going. Whereas on the left, we tend to sort of have a more reactive approach, like the Kavanaugh situation. Like everybody becomes alarmed, or Obama gets elected, everybody's excited, but then the enthusiasm dissipates. The organization and infrastructure isn't quite there, and so we don't have the same consistency of effort. We tend to be more episodic.
So going forward, what strategy do you think the left should adopt?
Well, in a way, I think the money quote from the Powell memo is something worth reiterating. As he wrote, strength lies in organization, in careful long-range planning and implementation, in consistency of action over an indefinite period of years, in the scale of financing available only through joint effort and the political power available only through united action and national organization. If we can keep that in mind, and that would certainly help a lot. And I think we're starting to see progress. I think the shocking nature of Trump's election, I think, has shocked a lot of people out, not only out of apathy, but understanding that we need to build for the long run and not just be in a reactive mode.
And finally, we're just over a week away from the midterm elections. How does that play into this idea of having a long-term strategy, and how does that fit into this whole discussion?
Yeah, one of the reasons I wrote the piece also was to just say that, we are in a very alarming situation. What Greg Palast shows with the voter suppression in over two dozen states means that the most immediate thing about the midterms is they're essentially a Band-Aid to prevent the bleeding, and that it's crucial that people turn out for that. People who, if they have the time, can participate in various ways with phone banking, canvassing, doing whatever they can for candidates they think will help. But yes, going beyond that, we need organization. We need to understand the importance of having both an inside and an outside strategy, having people voted in on the inside who at least sympathize with our agenda, but also that campaigns and the battle of ideas and all of that have to continue from the outside the day after the election. People can't just go home again, or we'll repeat the same cycle over and over again.
We'll have to leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us, John. For more information on this topic, you can find John's article, The Long Game, What the Left Can Learn from the GOP's Rise to Power, on the Indy's website, independent.org. That's Indy with a Y. Thank you for listening. You can catch us every Monday at 6 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 FM for all the latest from Indy Radio News. You can find this month's print edition of The Independent at our outdoor news boxes across the city and in local libraries, independent bookstores, and social movement centers. Follow all our latest coverage online at theindependent.org. That's Indy with a Y, and via social media. To let us know what you think of today's show, send news tips, or to find out how to subscribe to The Independent's print edition, we can be reached at 212-90-independent.org. Thank you so much to WBAI for hosting our show, and see you next week.